WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harrison. For Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. What's cooking? Well, just turn on the TV and find out. From the Iron Chef to America's Test Kitchen, Americans are whipping up culinary masterpieces with a frenzy. Or at least watching others do so. If you look inside today's well-stocked pantry, you'll find instant tapioca right next to the canned chicken broth. Freezers are stocked with flash-frozen berries, cookie dough, and a ration of chicken nuggets. Flashback to the 1950s, and you'll see a different picture. Enormous sums had been invested during World War II in new technology for dried and frozen foods for the troops. So the food industry was determined to cash in on the post-war consumer market, and it devised a battle plan to take over America's kitchens. The war plan wasn't pretty. In fact, it was downright ugly and devious. The food industry tried to convince women that they just weren't up to the task of preparing dinners. They spent millions in advertising campaigns to drive home the message that cooking was just too hard for America's housewives. Well, the women fought back with flour and fury. Author Laura Shapiro tells the wickedly delicious story of this kitchen fight that changed women's roles in and out of the kitchen in the new book, Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America. What are your memories of food in the 50s and 60s? Instant Jell-O? Spam? Frozen broccoli? Are we now just a defrost and microwave nation? And what does that mean? And these days, after a long day, do you feel guilty about serving your family pizza or takeout for dinner? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now is Laura Shapiro, author of the new book, Something from the Oven. Welcome, Laura.
Hi.
Great to have you with us.
And thank you.
I have to say, it surprised me how often I found myself laughing out loud at some of the foods that you describe in the book. And I remember eating tuna noodle casserole with potato chips crumbled on top.
You were eating a classic.
Yes, I was. Who knew? And I wonder what your favorite weird recipe was from the book.
There were a flock of truly peculiar things that that came across my research, and I have
lists and lists of them. Some of them got into the book. What's amazing about some of these foods that came from the food industry's test kitchens was that they had no relation to what we think of as breakfast, lunch, or dinner. They just were impossible to classify. So you might see a story that featured tomatoes with little cheese sprinkled on top and banana slices on top of that and mayonnaise on top of that and the whole thing broiled. But they never told you when you might want to eat it, if indeed you did. Or they had half a donut, for instance, which you could cover with a slice of canned cranberry jelly and you could put cottage cheese on top of that. But again, why would you do these things? So they were tremendously fond of putting these foods together because these were recipes entirely devised to sell certain foods, and then just sort of putting them out in the stratosphere and hoping that Americans would find a way to fit them into daily life.
And so who was the they that thought we actually wanted to eat that way?
These were the people who were working industriously in the test kitchens of food companies. They were aware that cooking by opening boxes was not the way most American women wanted to cook. It didn't have the kind of emotional heft of cooking. It didn't have the work and it didn't give you the sense of accomplishment that you went into the kitchen to get. So they had to get past all that, redefine the word cooking to mean just opening boxes, and try to put a whole other vision of dinner on the American table. And that's where these recipes came from.
And so it took them a while to change people's attitudes, but it does sound as if women were over time willing to buy into this notion that food that was frozen or dehydrated or canned was actually just as good, maybe even better than something from their gardens or the local farm stand or, you know, the grocery store around the corner.
Well, it wasn't so much that housewives bought into the idea. It's that they began to believe the rhetoric. The food industry had been saying, I think this started in the 30s, and it became an incredible drumbeat of rhetoric after World War II. They'd been saying, home cooking is dead. Nobody cooks at home anymore. Everybody is opening boxes. brides are starting married life knowing only how to use a can opener. They were announcing the death of home cooking, starting, as I say, right after World War II. And they announced it, and they announced it, and they announced it. And after a while, people started to believe it. And these were even people who cooked themselves, and they started to feel as though they were the only ones who were still cooking. So it was more that the food industry was able to change the atmosphere. They were able to change the rhetoric. They were able to change the message that was swirling around the supermarket and the home. I think people really were eating a lot of the same foods that they were always eating. I mean, meatloaf was around for many, many decades, and it would continue to be around for many decades. It didn't go away.
And you have to wonder why, too, because, you know, was there really that much Spam left over after the war?
There was Spam, and there was not only Spam, but they had six or eight other kinds of canned meat that they were trying to push. They had canned fried hamburgers that they thought was just exactly what housewives were dying to do. They had a canned Jell-O that had been specially formulated for battlefield conditions. You could hold it with, and it would never lose its shape. And they were trying to put that on the market before they relaxed the formula a bit for home use. They really thought that people were going to rush out and buy these things. And when they didn't, the food industry had to kind of reformulate the way they thought about it and try to think up some strategies to win people over to these.
And so what did they come up with?
Well, one thing they came up with was a technique that became very popular. This was called glamorizing, where you might not want to just open a can and serve the contents to people. That would not be nice. It'd be a little bit déclassé. But you could glamorize it by adding a can of something else, say a canned pineapple, no matter what the first can was. Canned pineapple would glamorize it. Or you could set it on fire. That was a great technique for glamorizing. And people went out and glamorized everything that they made. And that actually won over a lot of hearts and minds. The idea that you could rather easily make something that didn't look too much like canned and packaged food, and it was kind of raised a little bit in the social scale. It looked a little bit more like company cooking, and that appealed to people.
And also that it was okay if you used a cake mix if you put the egg in, but otherwise it was just really too easy.
Well, the egg story, the egg theory of how cake mixes became acceptable was, I think, maybe partly true. It was true that they knew, of course, when they invented cake mixes in the late 40s, they knew how to make a complete mix. They had dried eggs in there and everything else, and you really did only have to add water. And women resisted this product. The idea that you would get a cake from a box was just, that was guilt personified. You were not going to do that. This would not be a cake from the heart. So they called in consultants, and they decided that if they left the dried eggs out and had women add their own eggs, then it would be more of their creativity and their personal input into the act of baking, and the cake mix would be a more legitimate product. As I say, that's a kind of story that's been in cake mix lore for many years. I think there is truth to it, but I also think that the thing that really turned cake mixes around was frosting. Once they started to advertise the fact that you could make a cake your own by putting, you know, 3 hours of work into decorating it, somehow this really convinced people that they had done something. And they had. They had made a little yellow cake look like a football field or a ball gown or a Valentine display. And sure enough, with the addition of incredibly elaborate frosting and directions for decorating cakes, cake mixes definitely crossed over from kind of the forbidden field of packaged foods into real cooking.
That made it yours. What are some of the products that didn't make it, no matter how much they were advertised?
Well, there was something called the honeymoon breakfast for two. This was a frozen breakfast that was enough food for two people, and you would defrost it and put it in the oven the way you did a frozen dinner, but somehow this never went over. Then when frozen fish sticks became very popular, all the frozen food people rushed back to their laboratories and tried to create frozen ham sticks, frozen onion-flavored poultry sticks. They had eggplant sticks. Mm. They had lima bean sticks. These things did not work.
And it's also ironic, as you point out, that there was this whole frozen food industry before most people had freezers. I mean, did they not know that? How could there be that kind of disconnect?
I often wondered when I was reading the frozen food trade literature when they were going to figure this out, that there were no freezers in the late 40s and early 50s. They started to come in as the new refrigerators started to come in after the war. They would have a little freezer compartment. But home equipment for freezing was really not widespread until well into the 50s. So one thing the industry did was when they figured this out and they realized that a lot of people were saying that they didn't have room in a small house or an apartment for a big chest freezer like the kind that the food industry wanted to sell everybody. If they didn't have room for it, the industry thought, well, maybe we could sell them freezers that looked like a beautiful piece of furniture, and you could have it in the living room, even the bedroom. So they actually designed some freezers that would look like a big radio console or a handsome credenza. You could keep it covered with a cloth and then, you know, flip everything off when you wanted to actually get into it. There was a wonderful anecdote that went all around the frozen food world about the family that was so convinced by this that they tried to get one of these gigantic, very fancy freezers into their home, and it had to be hoisted through the window into the bedroom. But this was not what you call big market penetration of these things. What helped frozen foods get across was the fact that refrigerators started to become very widespread with freezing compartments.
Hmm. And, you know, you don't really get into this in the book, or I don't think you do, but I'm wondering, just as we're speaking here, how much of this might have had to do with the war years when food was rationed, when there were shortages. You know, I wonder if there was a sort of psychology that was playing out as well of, you know, gather a lot of food in the house because who knew when there was going to be more.
There may have been some of that going on. There was certainly a connection between some of the foods that people saw during the war and the foods that they were seeing in the supermarkets afterwards. Frozen foods, for instance, were really a very new product in the war years. The frozen food industry had just started to kind of pick up speed late in the 30s, and then when the war came, they directed all of their energy and technology into the war effort and feeding the armed forces, just like the rest of the food industry. And regular consumers who had really never seen frozen foods, for the most part, didn't see them until the frozen foods began to appear in grocery stores because they had enough. They had an overflow. And this was how some people did see frozen foods. They also, because they were frozen and they were not canned, they didn't use up this tin ration. So they had they were available for fewer ration points, which meant that in war terms, they were a bargain. So you did have people starting to test a few of the early frozen foods during the war years. The quality of those early frozen foods, though, because the industry was so young, was really pretty horrible. So they didn't really woo anybody successfully. But in the years afterwards, there was a little reminder that they had seen some of these things earlier.
So it was food, but you would only loosely use that description on some of these items, right? Some of them tasted like cardboard and hay, I think, was one of the descriptions.
Yes, whenever they subjected any of these new products to supposedly objective taste tests, they always got back the most horrendous stream of adjectives, you know, tasteless, disgusting, take it away. But fortunately for them, they never allowed this to get in their way. At the end of such a report, you'd always see all these products were deemed satisfactory.
Ah. Well, we're talking this hour about how the food industry battled for the hearts and minds of American women in the 50s and changed their roles in and out of the kitchen, and how women see that job in the kitchen today. In 2004, how is the food industry battling for your heart and mind? Is it winning? Is there an emotional payoff for you when you pull out all the stops making dinner? Whose style is more like yours, Poppy Cannon and the Can Opener Cookbook, or Julia Child? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the food industry's assault on America's home kitchens, how the push beyond or toward processed and frozen foods changed women's roles in the kitchen and beyond. Do you think women are still defined by the efforts they put into feeding their families? Do you yearn for the days when cooking was a daily accomplishment? Is it still that way for you? Are you baking from scratch or defrosting a ready-made pie crust? And does it matter? What message do you want your children to get when they see you over a hot stove? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with Laura Shapiro, author of the new book, Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America. What was it that got you started on this topic, Laura?
Well, I had been thinking really all my life about women and cooking, and one day, this is actually true, one day I was walking around our apartment in New York, and a question sort of floated into my mind, do women like to cook? And I started to walk all around that question in my mind, and I realized that for most of human history, you could not ask that question. It's like asking if women like to breathe, do women like to get up in the morning? But after World War II, when you started to have ready-made foods and packaged foods on the market, that opened up a little space between women and cooking, and you could ask that. And then I realized that even before the question could be uttered, it had been answered. It was answered by the food industry and by advertisers who said, no, women hate to cook. And that got me thinking and reading and looking at the 50s. The time when that question came to the forefront or not, but that the food industry moved right into women's lives and began to refashion housewives in its own image.
Well, and particularly after the war, as you point out, the notion was that science was going to emancipate women right out of the kitchen. And I'm wondering what evidence there was that they really wanted to be emancipated.
Not much. In fact, what they found out any time that anybody actually asked women about cooking, if they did a poll or a survey of any sort to find out how women felt about their household chores or what equipment they used, anything like that, the one thing that people generally liked about housework was cooking, or they disliked it less than they disliked everything else. People really didn't mind making dinner. Some women were good cooks and some women were very indifferent cooks, but they kind of didn't mind making dinner. And why not? Because cooking in the 50s was really easier than it had ever been in America. Everybody had gas or electricity. You could get your carrots, you know, bagged and washed at the supermarket. You had running water at home. It was not a big deal to make dinner. So this idea that the food industry came rushing in to liberate women, that science had freed them, they didn't need to be freed.
And those of us who had mothers who did not do a lot of cooking in the kitchen probably encountered some of these techniques for the first time in school, home ec. What were the home ec teachers teaching high school girls about how to cook?
Well, the home ec, the home economics departments in schools were hand in glove with the food industry, as they had been since the invention of home economics back at the turn of the century. And so what the home ec curricula had were, you know, how to defrost a package of frozen peas, how to make biscuits from a mix. And they would invent these gigantic long syllabuses and curricula for teaching people how to do these things. It was not cooking.
And what did all of this canned and processed food do to people's taste buds? I mean, this stuff was pretty uniformly bland, right? And it was either very salty or it was very sweet. Did it taste like real food?
You know, that was one of the things I thought of so much during my research. If only I could taste these things. But of course, that's the one thing you can't do. But we do know this ever since the turn of the century or since the Industrial Revolution, when Americans began to buy some packaged foods, ketchup came out of the late 19th century and Jell-O and, you know, marshmallows and a lot of these things that are icons at the American table. They had, by the 50s, these things had been around for 50 years or more. So people knew them and they had kind of become accustomed to eating from a somewhat industrialized food supply. Their palate, the American palate, had grown adapted to this industrial taste. Our palates were very different by the 50s than, for instance, European palates were. Remember, we were Americans. We were the people who invented the ginger ale salad. We were the people who were basting the roast duck with 7-Up. We did this, and there was really nothing you could do to offend our palates. We understood that a meal might ricochet from bland to incredibly sweet to very salty to some unbelievable jolt of flavor that seemed to come from another planet. People were used to this kind of thing. So it wasn't so much the flavor of these foods that put people off from the products of the food industry. It was the fact that you didn't have to cook to get them. I think it was the cooking that was the great challenge. The fact that it wasn't cooking that was the great challenge to the food industry, not the flavor of the things. Americans could accept anything in terms of flavor.
And seemingly did. 1-800-423-8255 is our number to share your food memories. We're going to Madison, Wisconsin now. We want to hear from Tekla. Hello and welcome.
Hi. I thought it was very funny when your guest was saying that packaged food wasn't home cooking, because it has always been my impression that was home cooking. If you cooked at home, it was home cooking. And I told the person who answered the phone that when I was first dating the guy that's my husband, that my roommate and I invited him over for a home-cooked meal. And we had frozen chicken and potatoes from a box and canned peas. And he thought it was really funny, and he thought it was a joke. And he said, okay, where's the real food now?
Thanks, Tekla. I'm sure you heard a lot of those stories, Laura, as you were doing your research.
Yes, and it's particularly nice to hear it from the heartland, from Wisconsin, where we think of everybody as still pulling these, you know, gorgeous casseroles and things out of the oven. And here is somebody who proudly speaks for home cooking totally out of boxes. Actually, there is something extremely nice about that. I still believe that if it's a meal served at home and the family is gathered around to eat it, you know, it counts. It counts as home food, even if it isn't home cooking.
I take your point. And speaking of the heartland, say it isn't so. There really wasn't a Betty Crocker. You know, that was such an icon for so many of us who came of age in the 50s and 60s. So if she didn't really exist, why was she created?
Well, she was created because people needed her, clearly. She came to life, in a sense, in 1921 as an advertising figure. They had a tradition in the advertising world of inventing these home economists who would be the human face of an impersonal food company. Betty Crocker, as I say, she came to be in 1921. She was one of the oldest. In the 50s, they had dozens of them representing all kinds of food companies. They had Kay Kellogg and Ann Pillsbury and all these people. One of my favorites was Marcia Camp, who represented Campfire Marshmallows. So all these companies would put forth these little pen and ink portraits of the woman who would explain to housewives how to use these products and be a kind of human bridge between the weird foods and the home cook. Betty Crocker was one of the few who lasted straight through the century, and she's, you know, as well known today as she ever was. The 50s was really her heyday, though. She was on radio, she was on television, she was in newsprint and in magazine ads. She was known to something like 99% of Americans. Everybody knew that calm face and that red jacket and her dark hair and that impeccable command of every single thing to do in the kitchen.
Yes, I was going to say, she's a real voice of authority, no question. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts now. Jan is on the line. Hi, Jan.
Observations and questions for your wonderful guest. It's a wonderful show, bringing back all kinds of memories. As I'm here in my kitchen cooking up a very quick pasta, making salad and slicing bread, being a product of the sort of lower middle class ethnic neighborhoods of Boston in the 1950s and 60s, and having grown up in neighborhoods where Chinese and Jewish and Italian cooking predominated, the sort of food products you're describing were something rather exotic and in the background, and occasionally there'd be a can of Campbell's soup on the table. There was ketchup, but for the most part, these Chinese and Jewish, German-Jewish mothers and Italian mothers, and I should say fathers too, were making foods that were pretty, I don't want to say healthy, but pretty basic, sauces and meats and rice and things, and kugels that did not require the kind of manufactured quality you're describing. I'm wondering, is your book and did your research focus on a particular sort of, Gentile, WASP, Anglo-Saxon milieu, or did you find that there were these, you know, the jellos and the things you're describing were more widespread than I evidently observed growing up?
Good question, Jan. Thanks for the call.
There was, it is a good question. I think two things were operating there. There's no question that packaged foods, especially frozen foods, entered the American kitchen first through upper middle class, upper income families, in part because the things were expensive, and in part because, as one survey showed, those upper income housewives thought of themselves as very busy because they were doing volunteer work. Some of them may have had jobs, but they had they were, you know, taking the children to dancing lessons and piano lessons and so forth. And they felt that they needed those products. Women who were in the middle class and working classes probably were not as aware of them, and they were not going to spend the money on them. And it's truly thanks to those women and to the ethnic cooks and the ethnic neighborhoods that this caller is describing that we have food today in America. I mean, who knows what would have happened if these products had penetrated widely. I also did come across in my research, though, a sense that out in rural areas where people were getting all their food, you know, right from around them, the sight of a package of dehydrated potatoes that, or a package of Delmonico potatoes or something that came from a box, that was something that was exotic. It was modern. You could save up for it and have it once in a while. And it was like a taste of another world that could come into your life when you felt rather remote from the city and things that were going on. So there were kind of two different ways of looking at those products. And the other thing that was going on is that the Chinese and the Jewish families and their neighborhoods and their foods that this caller is describing did not go unnoticed by the makers of packaged foods. Some of the earliest frozen products were frozen chopped liver, frozen egg rolls. One of the first TV dinners was a Chinese dinner. For some reason, it had tomato sauce ladled over it, but they called it a Chinese dinner. So even the food companies had this sense that there was an ethnic food market out there, and they wanted to get into it. And they prided themselves on introducing white middle-class Americans to some of these ethnic foods through frozen foods. I would be very sorry to think that somebody's first chopped liver was frozen chopped liver, but I hope it wasn't that way.
Well, and how interesting, because what Jan was describing is what we would now think of as comfort food. You know, I don't hear anybody being nostalgic for, oh, we used to have these great TV dinners. You pull the foil back and, you know, there would be some peas hiding underneath. In fact, there's an ad that you quote in the book. I wonder if you'd read it for us, because it describes this stuff in such glowing terms.
This is an ad for the Swanson TV dinner, and it shows a young bride and her husband, and he has the newspaper open at the table, and she's just coming to the table with two nice frozen dinners, and the ad says, "How to make dinner and the double feature too. Serve Swanson TV brand dinners. You and all happy eaters will appreciate their extra good taste. Swanson TV meatloaf dinners, for instance. Juicy beef with tomato sauce of rare distinction, plus whipped potatoes and garden peas. Brighten your next busy day with Swanson TV dinners, six delicious kinds. Only Swanson comes so close to your own home cooking."
But people didn't really go for these until they became TV dinners, right? As if that made them okay. If you ate them in front of the television, then somehow you were excused from eating good food.
Right. In fact, this ad, the thing I didn't read, is probably the most important part of the whole ad. It's way down in the tiny print where it says TV and TV dinner are registered trademarks. That was really the thing that put those Swanson frozen dinners over. Swanson came a little bit late to the frozen dinner market. There had been a couple of other companies that were out there doing frozen meals in aluminum trays. But they were not national companies like Swanson was, and they didn't have this vast advertising budget as Swanson did, and they didn't have the genius that Swanson did in calling them TV dinners. Once that happened, these products were out there. But they didn't replace cooking. They didn't become food. They became the thing that, you know, the babysitter heated up for the kids when you went out to eat. They didn't become cooking from the heart, from the kitchen. The food industry, in one of its many surveys, asked women, this was late in the 50s, asked women, would you serve a frozen dinner if, you know, your husband's boss was coming to dinner? People practically shrieked in horror on the reply thing that they were filling out there. You can see the agony at the very thought of this. And they said, no, of course they wouldn't. It'd be humiliating and terrible.
Although you have to wonder if they would still remember how to cook if they had been doing all of this. And in fact, there's another story you tell about the two shopping lists that women were able to determine who was the good mom, you know, who was the good cook, from what she bought versus someone who didn't buy so much convenience food.
Yes, this was an experiment or a test in how to elicit people's real opinions about products. And the people who devised it wrote up two shopping lists that were identical, except that one of them had instant coffee on it and the other one had regular ground coffee. And they gave the instant coffee shopping list to 50 women, and they gave the other shopping list to another 50 women, and they asked each group to describe the woman who had made up that list. And the results were just devastating to the food industry. It was crystal clear what people thought about packaged foods, because the women who were describing the person who had instant coffee on her list just described her as the most horrible person in town. She sleeps late. She never wears makeup. She's probably an old maid. She just she doesn't know how to cook. She was the worst person they had ever met. The other woman, the woman who used real coffee, and in fact everything on her list was real food, was Mother of the Year. She was this lovely homemaker and housewife. She was Mrs. America. So the difference was very clear.
We are discussing cooking in post-war America, how in the late 1950s, the food industry, with all of its processed and frozen foods, changed women's roles in and out of the kitchen. Some say for better, others say for worse. Did Spam make its way to your dining room table? Do you feel guilty today if you top a pie with canned whipped cream? And what is a woman's role in the kitchen? Join us. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about sweet potatoes stuffed with peanut butter, frozen lemonade salad dressing, and how in the 1950s the food industry set out to challenge taste buds and women's roles in the kitchen. How have those changes lingered till today? We're speaking with Laura Shapiro, author of the new book, Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America. We want to go to our phone lines to Marion, who's on the line from Whitman, Massachusetts. Hi, Marion.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I am a personal chef. I have owned a restaurant before, as well as a catering business. And I wanted to bring up the point that although women have been in the kitchen for so many years, men are chefs, and I'm on the radio. I'm so sorry.
Go ahead, Marion.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm so sorry.
Marion, I think we got your point about the chef versus the female cook, and it's also one that Laura makes in the book.
Yes, this is an ancient division of chores when it comes to cooking. Women do the home cooking, the day after day cooking, the cooking when people are hungry, the peanut butter sandwiches for the kids type cooking. And men do the glorious cooking for pay and for applause. What is interesting in the 50s is the way that starts just a bit to break down. For the first time, you see men coming forward to do the kinds of daily cooking that that they really were not doing, I think, earlier in the century. And one of the fascinating sort of emblematic foods is salad, which for a century or more had been a quintessential feminine food. It was women who ate salads and men who ate these huge slabs of beef. But now, in the 50s, you're starting to see men in the magazines, that is, stories about men who are upwardly mobile, and they have the new refrigerators and stoves in their kitchens, and they're swabbing out their wooden salad bowls with garlic, and they never wash the salad bowl, and they're shopping all over for the ripest camembert, and making these exotic Mexican dishes that they learned when they were visiting Mexico on their honeymoon. And in some of these stories, the wives are presented as these sort of helpless little creatures in the kitchen who can't do a thing, and it's the men who have taken over the show. It's very interesting. You mostly, however, see men still in the exalted French chef mode, but it's interesting. They are starting to cook, and then by the end of the 50s and the beginning of the 60s, where Julia Child comes in full glory and directs her show very specifically to men and women. She wants the whole family out there. The show is on at 8 p.m. She is talking to men as well as women because she knows that the only way to truly legitimize home cooking and to make it a respected thing and to give it the honor and the substance that it deserves is to have men in the kitchen.
And 8 days after her program went on the air in 1963, there came Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique. And I wonder, why was Julia's message so powerful to women, particularly after they'd been told for years that cooking was so hard, only a man could do it? And do you see a conflict or an overlap with Friedan's message to get out of the kitchen?
This was one of the first things I learned when I started to do this research in this whole post-war era was that Julia Child had gone on television in this one day in February in 1963, and 8 days later, The Feminine Mystique had been published. And I thought, this is meaningful. This is a confluence that has to mean something. But I just left it there. I didn't sort of rush the point. And the more I read in the 50s and the more I thought about these two people, I realized that it wasn't just a coincidence. Both of those women had an enormous audience waiting for them. There was no lag time for people to latch on to Julia or to latch on to Betty. You know, the minute she appeared on WGBH as the French chef, letters started coming in. People recognized her on the street. They wanted more. All the TV stations lined up to get this. It was instantaneous. And when The Feminine Mystique came out, again, people are talking about it. It's in all the papers. Everybody's life seems to resonate to this message. So they both had an audience. I finally realized that they were saying the same thing. They were saying to women, you can do this. You can stand at the center of your life. You can make your own life. You don't have to open boxes. You can use your own two hands. You are in charge.
Well, Laura Shapiro, thanks so much for joining us this past hour. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome.
Laura is the author of Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America. And you can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In just a moment, a new Bob Woodward book examines the lead-up to the war in Iraq. This is On Point. In his new book, Plan of Attack, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Bob Woodward gives the first behind-the-scenes account of how the Bush administration decided to go to war in Iraq. Last night on 60 Minutes, Mike Wallace asked Woodward about the administration's lack of post-war planning.
There seems to have been no real plan post-war.
There were innumerable briefings to the president about currency, about oil, and on the real issue of security and possible violence, they did not see it coming.
They really believed that they were going to get flowers and kisses.
Some of the exiles told them that. I think the president was skeptical of that. I think people like Cheney believed it more.
Woodward, who famously helped uncover the Watergate scandal, is once again raising eyebrows in Washington, this time with a candid account of division in Bush administration ranks. Marvin Kalb is a senior fellow and founding director of Harvard University's Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. I asked him what he saw as the most important revelations in Bob Woodward's plan of attack.
Well, there are two things that strike me as quite stunning. A lot of other things we have heard ripples of before. But one, whether in fact $700 million was diverted from the Afghanistan operation to finance a private secret Iraq preparation for war operation. I'm not sure, and I know a number of people on the Hill are scurrying around on this particular issue, but I don't believe that is doable. I think it is illegal if that is indeed what happened. The second stunning revelation to me had to do with the informing of the Saudi Arabian ambassador, Prince Bandar, that we were going to go to war in Iraq, according to Woodward, 2 days before the president informed the Secretary of State, Colin Powell. And then a comment reported by Woodward, made by the Saudi ambassador to the president, that Saudi Arabia would increase oil production before, several months before the election this November, in order to lower oil prices for the American people and help reelect the president. That is rather amazing to me.
Although apart from those and a few other bits of new information, much of the book seems to mostly connect the dots for us, shows us how things moved from decision to decision. And I'm wondering how you see this, the importance of it coming from Bob Woodward, someone who has been connecting the dots on big Washington stories since Watergate.
That's right. And there's an old saying here in Washington, and that is that when Woodward is prepared to listen, Washington speaks. And my sense is that this is another one of those amazing Woodward performances. It is absolutely amazing to me that so many top officials of the U.S. government, including the president, twice in preparation for this book by Woodward, twice talking to Woodward, all of the officials, top officials who talked to him. It is so very rare that anybody ever has claimed that Woodward is wrong. And I'm a bit stunned also by the fact that Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, has gone on record as saying that Woodward might have that $700 million issue wrong, that it came from general funding. Well, I know that there are a lot of people up on the Hill today who are looking into that, and maybe we'll learn more about it. But Woodward is the most extraordinary reporter in this city, bar none.
And what kind of impact do you suspect this will have on the campaign? I mean, Senator Kerry certainly leaped on it immediately. On Sunday, he mentioned it at several of his campaign appearances and said, you know, the president even misled members of his own administration.
Yes.
Is that the kind of thing that really resonates with the public, do you think?
I don't know that it resonates in and of itself with the public, but it adds to questions that have been raised about the administration's policy in Iraq by its response to 9/11 over the last month or two. And so people continue to hear questions about the White House and the president's operation. And I think there is something special about Woodward in that people take him seriously. You could question Richard Clark's book and his account of 9/11 and that famous August 6th memo that the president saw when he was down at his Texas ranch. But it's very difficult to question Woodward simply because his record over so many books and so many years that he's been a reporter for the Washington Post has been so remarkably clean and untouchable. I am unaware up until this moment of anybody really taking after Woodward or saying that he is wrong.
Well, and he also seems to lay out quite a story about how little consideration there was given to the consequences of going to war. I mean, we see a lot of deep involvement by the president in the details of the invasion, not so much about what might happen next.
That's absolutely true. They did think about a number of things. For example, they did spend a lot of time thinking about oil reserves and what would happen to the oil wells, because they remembered that Saddam Hussein, after the Kuwait War in 1991, did blow up a lot of the oil wells, and there were huge fires across the landscape for literally for months on end. They were concerned about that and did take action about that. They were concerned about a flood of refugees spreading into other countries. But they were not concerned about what would happen inside the country with the people themselves. They assumed in a very simplistic way that the Shia in the South would receive the Americans warmly, that the Kurds would receive the Americans warmly, that the Sunnis might be a little cool, but they would certainly be controllable. And all of those calculations and assumptions have proven to be quite problematic, mistaken in many cases.
Overall, Marvin, do you think it is critically important for people to read books like this that draw back the curtain on how decisions are made in the White House? Or do you think in some way it makes them perhaps deeply cynical about how those decisions are made?
That's a good point. It may very well increase the level of cynicism to a certain degree. Yes, I think so. But what is fairly remarkable at the same time is that this is an administration that has credited itself with being so tight with information, so secure in the way in which they keep secrets. And yet, when they want to talk, they do talk. And there's no question that the very top people have talked at great length to Bob Woodward, and he has recorded it in his usually methodical way, one fact after another. And I return to the $700 million question once again. If Woodward says flat out that the Congress was not informed, whether you argue that the money came from a special Afghan fund or from general military funds that the Pentagon had, you still have to inform the Congress, because this is taxpayer money. You've got to inform the Congress about how you're going to spend the money. And it appears from Woodward's account that the administration did not do that.
Notwithstanding the fact that the Constitution insists on it.
Ah, yes.
Marvin Kalb, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Bye.
Marvin Kalb is a senior fellow and founding director of Harvard University's Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. He spoke with me from Washington. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Stanley Chang, Michael Garth, Jane Manners, and Darren Mnuchin. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.